Fed up, as I was, with Princeton, Matt Polly put his degree on hold and moved to China to study Kung Fu with Shaolin monks. Rigorously devoting himself to it for 2 years, he became the first American accepted as a Shaolin disciple and went on to write a book about his experience, American Shaolin, Flying Kicks, Buddhist Monks, and the Legend of Iron Crotch, An Odyssey in the New China. Published in 2007. Later in life, he entered the MMA arena as a participant and journalist, traveling the globe for another 2 years, as he had before, training with renowned masters across disciplines. This became Tapped Out, Rear Naked Chokes, The Octagon, and The Last Emperor, An Odyssey in Mixed Martial Arts, published in 2011. Most recently, he penned Bruce Lee, A Life. Happy listening.
Matthew Polly, thanks so much for coming on the show.
It's a pleasure, Scott. Thanks for having me.
No worries. I like to begin my interviews a lot of the time by going back to Almost Famous. It's one of my favorite movies, Cameron Crowe film.
A great
and
one.
At the end of the movie, the kid, William, finally gets to interview Russell. And he says, you know, why do you love music? And so that's a nice place to begin, but you're not a musician, so I think I'll start with asking, who is Matthew Polly?
Oh, wow. So you started with a small question. I'm a writer. That's what I do for a living. I write books and other things. Father, husband, just a regular old dude who grew up in Kansas and moved out to the East Coast.
Cool. Okay. It's good. It's good grounding. So look, I wanna kick off with your first book here,
yep.
American Shaolin. How'd you find these guys, and how'd you get them to accept you? I read a lot of your interviews online.
Yeah.
I've looked into you, but the thing that's curious to me is how you convinced that. I mean, this is the days pre-internet, which is hard for a lot of people to understand or wrap their heads around now. But how start from the beginning, you know, or wherever that is for you.
Yeah, so I grew up in Kansas, and I was one of those skinny, scrawny kids who got bullied on the playground. Like a lot of us who get into martial arts, I saw a movie of Bruce Lee, Enter the Dragon, and was fascinated by the idea that you could learn these exotic oriental techniques and become a tough guy and no one would mess with you. And so when I got to college at Princeton, which I think you're familiar with, I took some martial arts. But even after a couple years of doing, you know, you go like Thursday night
and
exactly, you do club taekwondo and then you go home and you realize you go to the bar and you realize they'd still kick your butt. So I wanted to do something more intense. I kind of wanted to test myself the way, you know, young men are stupid and always want to do that. Yeah. So I went to a professor. I was studying Chinese, and I said, you know, I'm thinking about taking a leave of absence and going to China, and I want to study Kung Fu. And he asked me, he said, do you want to learn really real Kung Fu? And this is 1992, back when Tiananmen Square just happened, and China wasn't the great superpower then. It was more like sort of North Korea with better haircuts. So he said, if you want to learn really real Kung Fu, you have to go to the Shaolin Temple, which is what Bruce Lee was in Enter the Dragon. He was a Shaolin monk. It's one of the kind of legendary places. I had always assumed it was sort of fictional, kind of like the Knights of the Round Table.
Yeah.
But he had said it, and it sort of stuck in my brain, and this idea that you could actually go there. So this being pre-internet, there was nowhere to find out where it was. So I basically got on an airplane, landed in Beijing, and started asking people, where's the Shaolin Temple? And the funny thing was, the Chinese people had no idea either. So it took like 4 or 5 days before I finally found somebody from the province where the Shaolin Temple is located. Mm. And they pointed me in the right direction, and I jumped on a train and showed up at the temple, kind of expecting a windswept monastery, but it turned out to be kind of a third world Epcot center because it was a tourist attraction, tourist trap. And the way I got accepted was, it was run by the Communist Party, who had just switched to capitalism, and they set a price. And I was the only white guy, and within like 500 miles. And so the price was very high. for what other people were getting charged, but it didn't seem that high to me. So I signed up and the monks were kind of stuck teaching me. And I think they assumed that I would give up within a week or two. So they were very polite the way you are to sort of a guest that shows up from out of nowhere. But they, I just didn't leave. And so slowly they had to get used to me. I sort of became this like tall, skinny white mascot for the Shaolin Temple. And they'd bring me out and be like, here's the white guy, the American who loves Kung Fu so much. He came here to study here.
That's funny. Did you speak Chinese? Like, how did you?
I did. I'd taken 2 or 3 years and I did the Middlebury programs during the summer. So I spoke Chinese, but it was sort of like I sounded like a dumb 10-year-old. You know, I was when foreigners speak Chinese, they sound like there's something wrong. And so it took me a while to kind of get adjusted, but fortunately, you know, martial arts is, it's not like literature. So most of it is like, use power, hit harder, stop getting hit in the face. So the actual vocabulary you need is not that extensive.
Right. And so, but this, this didn't last 2 weeks. This lasted for 2 years.
That's right.
How did you fill the time for, you know, the 700 whatever days that is? 720 days, like what, you know, 28 days. What do you, 730 days. What do you,
what does one do? Yeah, I mean, the amazing thing is, and why I loved it was, it was so pure, right? There's no internet. There's two channels on TV, but it's Chinese propaganda channels. So there's nothing to watch. There's nothing to do. The Shaolin village at that time had about 10,000 mostly boys studying Kung Fu, and they would study it 8 hours a day. They didn't go to classes. They just studied Kung Fu. They got up in the morning, and they did forms, and they kickboxed, and they ran back and forth, and then they ate, and then they did it more. So all we did all day long was martial arts. And when we weren't doing martial arts, we were talking about martial arts. So I think what I loved most about it was the complete and total purity of focus.
Yeah. And a lot of time alone, I imagine, as well.
You did. Certainly there was time alone. But the monks who taught me were very gracious, and they would bring me out to stuff, and, you know, you'd go eat dinner and then talk and joke and laugh. And the Shaolin monks are allowed to drink, so we did a lot of drinking.
And, really?
Yeah, we did. Yeah. So they the Chinese love drinking games, and the Communist Party officials really love drinking games because they don't trust each other. And so the only way they can get along is to get shit-faced drunk, and then they sort of feel like they've made some sort of bond of trust. Yeah. And so all business is done with a copious, it's like Russia. It's like an extraordinary amount of alcohol. And so they taught me some drinking games, and then they would have me, whenever they had a guest from a high official from some other province, they'd have me go play the drinking games against him. And I got to be pretty good, so they thought it was hilarious that this white guy would beat some, you know, other provincial official in a drinking game.
It's funny. So you did, I mean, you did learn Chinese pretty decently at some point.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, by the end, I was pretty fluent. I wouldn't say 100%. It was very clear that I hadn't grown up speaking Chinese, but it was complete immersion. There were no other foreigners there. So you dream in Chinese. That's all you talk all day long. You start talking to yourself in Chinese. I think what's interesting, though, is you start adopting the values of the culture.
Yeah.
So, for example, one of their big Chinese, when you know, Chinese males are very obsessed with face, respect, and, you know, all the time they're saying, oh, he gave me face, or he didn't give me enough face, or you should give me face. And so after a while, I started to think in the same ways. You felt like some gangbanger, like, you disrespected me. I'm going to have to shoot you. So there was a real, it was the closest parallel, I think, in American culture, is that sort of very, very sensitivity to your various status and giving sort of respect along the status lines.
Yeah, absolutely. I speak French. I moved to France when I was a teenager and alone and lived there. And I found myself as a teenager, and now, you know, I've been back for various different classes and things over the years. When you're speaking the other language to yourself, there are things you can express that you don't really make sense in English, you know, or it's not even that they don't make sense in it. Well, first of all, there is not words in English in the same way that I'm sure there's English expressions that don't make sense in other languages. There are English expressions that don't make sense in other languages. I learned this when I dated and lived with a Mexican girl for the better part of a year. You express things linguistically and also culturally that wouldn't make sense somewhere else. So I assume you, had some of that over there.
Yeah, exactly. What you realize is that words take on emotional meaning over time. So a curse word means something because when you were 8, someone said it to you and everybody laughed. And so whenever that word comes up, that memory comes up. So when you learn a new language, you don't have any of the emotional memory. And so you have to acquire that over time.
That's an excellent point.
And so, you know, after a little while, so at first, there's a word, I'll give you an example. Wang ba dan is a turtle's egg. And that's one of the worst things you can say in Chinese to somebody. But in English, it's hilarious, right? There was some point where I just said that to someone and their face turned red and like they wanted to fight. And then I had an emotional memory with that word and it meant something different because I had the context of what it means. And so that's part of it. And then there's just different cultural values. So, another really great word in Chinese that not many people know of is, guanxi, which means sort of connections, but because China has been, because it was sort of a subsistence economy, almost everything got done through favors. It wasn't a market economy. So we get things done by giving money. I'll pay you this much and you do this. Mm-hmm. And they do a lot of things like you help me, you know, take this stuff to the store and I'll, you know, help you get talk to the local official and get your a permit for your new business. And so this idea of being connected to people through favors felt to me very much kind of like the mafia movies, like where everybody's, hey, I did him a favor and you do me one. And then, so you would go around and be like, you wouldn't say this is my friend. You would say this is my old guanxi in the sense of like, we're two guys who've done favors for each other so much that we're interconnected by the act of doing things for each other.
Yeah. Yeah. Three things come to mind here. First of all, so I spent the last 2.5-ish years in Australia. Mm-hmm. And when I first got there, everyone was calling each other cunts, which obviously, and for me, yeah, it was
right. Single worst word. It's like the second or third worst word in American English, right?
Yeah. And I'm thinking, have I done something to offend you? I'm sorry. And they're like, nah, cunt, you're all good. And I honestly couldn't understand it. And, you know, you do some Googling, you realize that that's just part of the lexicon. And I did live there for a while. So I came back to the United States, just calling everyone a cunt, saying cunt all the time. I searched my emails the other day and I found hundreds of
cunts.
Yeah. And I was just like, this might not be good.
We might need
to scrub it. But it is just, you know, it like blue or green or sky. It just, you know, it rolls off the tongue.
Yeah.
So that's one sort of comical example. As to guanxi, I lived in Jordan for a bit as well and had a scholarship to learn Arabic there when I was 19. I ended up getting kidnapped in the Jordanian desert by a group of angry Bedouins.
Well, yeah. You got a better story than I do then.
No, but anyway, it was right on the border with Syria too. But, you know, I don't even remember. This was 2016, so not the best time. But anyway, that in Arabic, there's a word wasta, which means, there's not really a translation, but it essentially means connections.
Right.
So it's sort of that same kind of Sopranos, Goodfellas, like, right. Yeah, he's a good fella. Like, we'll do something for him. He's one of us. He's going to help you. You're going to help him. It's a different kind of economy. And, you know, you have all these guys at Ivy League schools like the one we attended, you know, jerking off in anthropology classes to all of these. They're trying to interpret everything that's going on, the markets, the economies, but it's not. I don't know. I feel like I was really disillusioned. I don't want to go too far on this tangent. I didn't like anthropology because I felt like it was just a bunch of weirdos in New Jersey, like trying to like talk about Sikh pot, which is like the, you know, the communal eating pot thing. And I was just like, what? I don't know. It just felt so bizarre. It just felt like not everything needs to be microscoped like that. But anyway, yeah, like there's places where I don't know where I was going with that line of commentary, but there's places where the economies operate differently.
Yeah.
And the, you know, this is one of them.
Yeah. The economies operate differently, and that also affects the way people operate. I mean, I think the best thing, and you've obviously had it yourself, is when you live in another culture and you start to integrate and it starts to change your frame of reference, then you have a bifurcation in how you see the world. So even when you come back, you no longer see it purely through American eyes, and you could see it almost like an observer. So you have the sense of being of two places, especially if you stay in a place long enough, and you notice quirks that you just, you didn't notice before because they were just given.
Yeah.
And you know, I remember when I came back and, you know, I came back my senior year and everybody's running around worried about whether they're going to get the interview with Goldman Sachs. And I was like, what are the values of this place? Right. And so I think that's it's difficult sometimes when you first get back, you try to integrate the two selves. But one of the great values is you realize there's multiple ways to, you know, skin the cat, and there's multiple ways to organize a society, and ours is just one of them.
Yeah, and Princeton is a small slice of that society.
Exactly.
It's funny you mentioned Goldman Sachs. 20 years later, or however, you know, however many years after you graduated, they're up to the same tricks. I wrote a part of my first book was about this. I wrote about this, and Some things never change.
No, it's I mean, that is quite remarkable. When I first started, though, they hadn't gotten their claws in, and it was the bond salesman. So it was like different.
But it's another brand of the same tequila.
Of course. Yeah. You know, they're just hiring prestigious titles, and we're selling out to the highest bidder.
But this concept you mentioned of coming back and seeing things differently, being the outsider, is that related to the, pardon my pronunciation here, it's going to be horrendous, but Lao Wai. So did you feel like, you know, outsider in the US, outsider in China?
Yeah, I mean, being in China is the only American there.
First of all, what does the concept mean?
Yeah.
Try to describe it emotionally. Sure. in English.
So Lao Wai is actually a polite term, and they just mean it. Lao means old, and Wai means outside. So Lao is like, you know, old guy. It's like it's a affectionate term in Chinese. So it's like old outsider, meaning you're from a different place. I mean, one of the interesting things about China is the word for China, Zhongguo, means center country. Mm. And so, like a lot of places, they thought they were the center of the universe, and everybody else was barbarians. And for about 2,000 years, they were right. And so they had an idea that everybody who came outside of China was uncivilized and whatever. But if you're a Westerner, you know, that's the term they use for you, and it's still a polite term, but it meant that at every single place I walked, someone would go, look, Lao Wai, hey, Lao Wai. And so you're always being called outsider constantly. So you're never, now there's no single moment that I could go anywhere where I wasn't reminded that I didn't belong.
Right.
And that's I'd never experienced the sense of A, being a minority, but being a foreigner at every moment. And it kind of gnaws at you after a while, and you find yourself getting irritated at weird moments. And you sort of you're fine for a while, and then at a certain point you're like, I can't be an outsider forever. So it was interesting then to come back and then sort of feel strange and not quite like I fit in when I got back, because I'd had this experience. And the best comparison I could give is, I think this happened to a lot of soldiers, a lot of our veterans who went and served and then came back and had such an intense experience that they couldn't quite integrate properly when they got back. So it's not uncommon, but yes, it was an interesting thing to feel like a foreigner when I was over there and then feel like sort of half Chinese, not fully American when I got back.
Yeah, I feel that way. I am an outsider in a lot of the places that I go, and I've always kind of felt like one, but it's by design. This is my 40th city of the year. I move around constantly for work and just live out of this small carry-on suitcase, and that's a choice. I choose to do what I do, but I like, you know, this concept of ever the observer. There's that old, what is it, the David Foster Wallace, "This is water" speech, you know, you're familiar.
I'm not familiar with that one, though.
There's two young fish swimming along, and they're swimming along, and an older fish passes them, and he says, "Hey, boys, how's the water?" And they keep swimming, and one of the young fish turns to the other fish, and he said, "What the fuck is water?" And so when you're a Lawai coming back to the United States or wherever or going wherever, you see, as you mentioned, a lot of these quirks and things, because you recognize some of this water is here. The water you didn't even know, you know, existed
right.
before.
Yeah. Yeah. One of my favorite examples was when I was living in China at the time, it was still working through sort of, it was transitioning from the Maoist era to the Deng Xiaoping capitalist era. And there was an intense amount of corruption. So almost everything you could get, if you wanted to get anything done, you just sort of paid up front. And then I got back to America and I was like, oh, we have exactly the same amount of corruption. We just do it on the back end. You know, if you lobby and you pay for Congress people to have their campaigns, and then after they retire from Congress, then they go get this fancy job. So I thought what was interesting is that, like, no American actually thinks that we live in a deeply corrupt country, or for a lot have this kind of fantasy. We don't. And so coming from China, you could see the same system working, but just in different sort of ways. So you can see sort of aspects of your own society that others don't.
That's a good point. Yeah. An excellent point. Now, I want to shift gears a little bit and get into Iron Crotch.
Oh, yeah.
Literally, one of the best. what is it? I saw some of the pictures in the book. It doesn't look like the most pleasant thing in the world. I guess that's the point.
Yeah.
What is Iron Crotch?
So traditional Shaolin Kung Fu has several aspects. Some of it's the forms that you learn, which are basically connected moves. So like one form called small red boxing, everybody who starts Shaolin Kung Fu learns that form. It's got about 50 different techniques that are linked together. But another thing that every Shaolin monk does is perfect something called an iron Kung Fu. And that's where they try to turn one part of their body as hard as iron. So that, you know, if you have an iron fist and you hit somebody in the face, your fist doesn't break, his face does. And so you train that by hitting it against increasingly hard material. Like you start with wood and then you move on to stone or metal.
And you don't break your hand along the way, or you do?
No, you're trying not to break it. You're trying to slowly toughen it, right? So
like callus, is there a science? There's science here somewhere.
Yeah, obviously they've done it for thousands of years. So they have it's a science in the sense that there's been experimentation. So for example, there was a guy, if you have an iron stomach, that you would just sort of, they would hit you with increasingly hard things across your stomach until you got to the point where your stomach could break, say, a board coming across it.
Yeah.
So the idea is, of course, to turn your body into kind of armor, or a weapon. And it, you know, there are other examples. For example, in Muay Thai kickboxing, they do a lot of kicks roundhouse kicks where they connect with their shin bone. Mm-hmm. And the shin is, if you've ever gotten kicked in the shin, hurts, right? It hurts a lot. That's why soccer players have pads over their shins.
Yeah.
And they don't when they do Muay Thai. So what they do instead is you kick a bag that's filled with sand, and then you have increasingly harder and harder sand, and then you kick a bamboo tree, which is harder. And then
I did Muay Thai. Oh, yeah. A bamboo tree.
Yeah.
I mean, I know this is the point.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Continue. Sorry.
Yeah. So the point is that when your shin kicks somebody else in the thigh, his thigh, like the muscle breaks and bruises and he can't walk, and your shin doesn't break. So everybody does this. Boxers who train for years pounding bags, eventually their fists are just simply harder than a normal person's fist. Yeah. If you take somebody in their first day in the gym and you say, go hit that bag, the first thing that happens is they go, oh, ow, right? But if you hit the bag for 5 years, your fists will be tougher. So, you know, Iron Kung Fu is basically that principle sort of taken to an extreme. And Iron Crotch Kung Fu is a guy who could take like a full kick to the groin and not drop over, like not have it bother him. And I know that's true because he kind of came to the temple. He'd been associated with the temple and came back for a special performance. And nobody wanted to get up on stage and kick him. And so they dragged me out. And I kicked him in the groin. And he looked at me sort of like, is that all you got? And then I was like annoyed. So I kicked him 8 times in a row so hard I lifted him off the ground. And on the 7th kick, I could feel my foot pop from a bruise. From kicking him in the groin, and afterwards he was completely fine. So he had trained making that area of his body so used to punishment that he didn't feel anything there. And that's, I mean, obviously every guy knows what it feels like to get kicked there or punched there or accidentally hit something there, and we know how much it hurts. So that's why it has this kind of, it's exotic and cool and wild in a weird way, right? As opposed to having iron forearms, which is something I trained. But yeah, the Iron Crotch guy was a real crowd pleaser. Everybody, when he came out and performed, everybody like freaked out and were like, wow. And also the other thing that's hilarious about it is after the performance, a lot of women, Chinese women in the audience, like flocked him like groupies. Like they were so stunned by this and so kind of slightly turned on. And so the Iron Crotch Kung Fu master had a lot of girlfriends.
That's, were the monks allowed to have girlfriends?
No. So Shaolin monks are the only monks that are allowed to drink alcohol and eat meat. Because like 1400 years ago, they supposedly saved a prince who had been kept hostage. And when he became emperor, he granted them this privilege that as Buddhist monks, they could eat meat and drink alcohol. The real reason is probably because there were so many ex-military guys who retired to the Shaolin Temple whenever their patrons had fallen out of favor and they were given a choice, be executed or go be a monk. And that's how kind of Kung Fu got associated with the Shaolin Temple. It was the place you went after, you know, your warlord lost in some battle, you could go to Shaolin and shave your head and they wouldn't execute you. And so they allowed them to eat meat and drink alcohol, which is something no Buddhist monks are allowed to do anywhere else, but they're supposed to be celibate. They're not supposed to have kids.
Can they jerk off?
Well, I don't know. That's a great question. That's like a Catholic question, right? Do they go blind? So I never asked. That's great. No one's ever asked me that question. No, I didn't ask when I was there, and I assume the answer is I think you can, because it wasn't about sex itself. It was about attachment. And the difference between Buddhism and Christianity is Christianity has a thing against sex, like any sort of pleasure of the body, whereas Buddhism didn't have any opinions about sex one way or the other, but they did have an opinion about if you want to achieve enlightenment, you can't be attached to this world. And sex attaches you to the person, and then you have kids, and that, of course, there's nothing more attaching than having children, because then suddenly all you can think about is how to help your children, presuming you're a decent parent.
Right. Based on that presumption.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a big jump. Not everyone cares that much about the kids. But you know what I'm saying. So, you know, one of the things you do when you become a monk is you give up your name. So you have no family attachment. You shave off your head so you show you're not a member of society. You wear these robes so you don't wear the fashions of the day. Everything is about the process of detaching you from the world.
Right.
And so having sex, not allowing to have sex, is another way you're supposed to detach yourself from the pleasures of the world. And that's why most temples don't allow the monks to drink alcohol or eat meat. You're supposed to essentially get to a state where you're basically just spirit, right? There's nothing of the flesh that matters.
Mm. What? Let's talk about this concept of eating bitter. What does it mean, and how did it play out, like literally, but also, you know, in your mind?
Yeah, so that's one of the phrases that I picked up at the Shaolin Temple because it was used all the time. And the Chinese have the idea of there's eating sweet, which is pleasure, and eating bitter, which is suffering or pain. And in studying the martial arts, there was a value placed on suffering for its own sake. It not only made you better, but it kind of grounded you in a way. So, for example, if you're a person who's used to a sweet life and someone hits you in the face, it's a total shock. But if you're used to a bitter life and you get hit in the face, it's sort of like, it's Tuesday, right? I get hit in the face frequently. Well, that doesn't bother me. So the idea was the suffering, your training should involve suffering just for the hardening aspect of it, for your spirit, for your mind, for your soul. And so they would say, you know, something like, a huge compliment for me. One of the biggest compliments I got early on was I was training extra to try to make up for the fact that the everybody else had started at a very young age, and I was starting at the age of 20. At some point they go, the foreigner, he can really eat bitter. And someone goes, yeah, he can really eat bitter. And I was like, when I heard that, my heart sang, because that was about as high a compliment as you could give to someone. Are they capable of eating bitter? Are they capable of going through the suffering and not complaining and not giving up? And so, you know, we have this, you know, if you go to a football team in Texas, they have similar kind of concepts, right? You know, that you just got your bell rung, you know, you got to be tough. In MMA, they had the, like, you know, iron sharpens iron. You know, there's a lot of tough guy sayings, but it's very central to the kind of Chinese culture, the idea of bitterness and the idea of suffering as a value. And I think that's one of the things I found most interesting coming back to America, because we have an entire society built on the avoidance of pain, right? You know, the opioid epidemic is an example of, like, what is it? We found a drug that would, like, remove some form of pain, and the entire tens of millions of people got addicted to it. So the idea of pain avoidance as being the highest good, that you should never at any moment suffer. Everything should be a safe space. Like, no one should ever get hurt or have their feelings challenged or have something bad happen. Or, you know, the idea of eating bitter is in a consensual context, right? You agree to go into this area where you're going to be hurt, but you agree to it in order to be hurt, in order to gain the kind of toughness that will be of value later in life.
I think it's a good concept from which we might benefit today.
I mean, look at all. There's some value in it. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, I think America's values in general, don't get me wrong, I'm very grateful to have an American passport and sure, proud to be an American, but so many fat people in this country, you know?
Yes, that's something you realize when you come back.
Yeah. And so, nothing wrong with the fatties, but, like, I mean, I'm just being a bit terrible here, but, like, it's an example of, you know, our portion sizes, and we're eating so much, and which is comfort food, and, yep, and, you know, obviously there's economic considerations, whatever, shitty sure food is cheaper, blah, blah, you know, whatever. Yep. This is not a food economics podcast. Point is, a lot of countries don't have the kind of issues that we have, because there's, like, this superabundance, and I think you summarize it nicely. We want to just increase our own comfort so much that we end up actually decreasing. It's like the hedonist who, in pursuit of so much pleasure, right, ends up making himself miserable.
Exactly. And I think that's a central point, which is the pursuit of happiness is not the same thing as the pursuit of pleasure or the avoidance of all pain. And I think our assumption is that happiness is associated with the great vacation or, you know, the beautiful wife or the perfect lawn or whatever it is. And so we fall into traps like obvious gluttony, right? We're twice as big as we were 60 years ago. And I think that that is associated to a kind of core value. And so the value of, you know, I have a young son and, you know, they live in he lives in a world in which everything has to be safe, right? Everything. He's not, there's
the words, no, the, yeah, yeah, yeah.
The words, you know, the car seat, the helmet, you know, everything is, he's always observed by an adult. You know, there's no point where he runs around on his own. Like we have to, there's a parenting method called free range parenting where you actually let your kid like run in the backyard. We have to come up with a concept for something. When I was growing up, that was like what you did. Like that was parenting, yeah, right? So we are increasingly a society in which like the avoidance of something bad happening, we're willing to do, apply a great deal of science and money for it. And there's a danger to it, which is, when something bad does happen, you are not prepared. And that's the Cherku example. Like the idea was you go out and you get hit a lot. And then when you're in a match, it's not a shock. Because the most surprising thing that happens in martial arts is, the first time you get hit, you're completely stunned. And then after a while, it doesn't bother you. So, it hurts, but it doesn't, there's no shock to it. And that's what you're training for. Yeah.
I'm just writing some of this down because it's valuable. Why'd you go back to Princeton? Why didn't you just, you know?
Yeah. Well, one of it was just simply, I got tired of being a foreigner always, you know, it was exhausting.
I know that feeling.
Yeah. You're just, you know, at a certain point you want to be in a place where no one looks at you different or treats you differently. And it gave me a great deal of sympathy for people who are minorities here because I had no idea what it felt like to always, like, you walk into a place and everyone turns and looks at you and they don't think they're doing anything wrong. But to you, it's like an insult. And it's alienating and otherizing. But, so there was that, there's no money in being I was one of the world's best Chinese kickboxers and that's not a.
You were?
Yeah, I was probably top 20.
How do you know what I mean?
Not I mean, I fought some guys who were top five and was pretty close. So
yeah,
I guess, you know, they didn't rank us. But amateur kickboxing obviously is not something you can do for a living. And, you know, at some point I was like, I have to actually get a job. And then I also think I realized at some point I didn't want to be a monk. I realized I was kind of a bourgeois kid from a bourgeois place and I wanted bourgeois things like a wife and a family and a career. And that passion that I had for kind of spiritual seeking and, you know, testing myself, it had been satisfied. Like I checked the box. And once I felt like I was confident enough, and I felt like I'd gained as much as I could out of the experience, I kind of wanted to move on.
It's interesting.
Also, I realized the other thing was a lot of the monks were going to other countries to teach martial arts. So people were like, well, why don't you come back and teach martial arts? And I was always like, well, they're like 100 times better than I am. So why would I go back to the States and teach Kung Fu? These guys are coming over to do it. So I was learning a skill at which I was always going to be inferior.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, for me, not that our stories are remotely similar. I think yours is a lot more interesting. mine is, you know, I went to Australia in my junior spring and for what was supposed to be 3 months. And I stayed for 3 years because of COVID. And I just stayed and finished Princeton online from Australia and was working in Australia.
All right. Still a great story.
Still, yeah, it was, look, it worked out. But for me, when I did eventually come back to the United States, which was after after 2 years and some change,
right?
2 years and a couple of months. I came back in the spring. I needed to have surgery and see family. And then I went back to Australia immediately after the surgery. Well, frankly, it just cost me less money here.
That's funny.
But I don't know. It was weird coming back to America. I did feel like an outsider.
Yep.
Maybe, and Australia is an anglophone
yep.
country, and I don't know. My friends there were from a bunch of different countries, but it was still sort of the West.
Yep,
it is the West. It's the only Western country in that part of the world,
yep.
probably.
Yep.
So I don't know. I don't know now, having come back. I'm 24, and now I'm back again for the holidays. I've sort of gotten rid of my apartment and whatever in Australia, not apartment, room that I was renting, to be more specific. But I don't know if I'll stay. Having I have the bug now. Go down to Latin America or something. We'll see.
Yeah, the one thing is, you can't go anywhere and not bump into Australians who are wandering the earth. So
they're rogue motherfuckers. they really are.
I made this joke once in Thailand. I was talking to this Australian. I was like, I don't think you guys actually have a country. I think you just wander around and claim you're the lost tribe of the Australian people, because I never see anybody who's actually in Australia, but you all are somewhere else. So yeah, definitely. I think what happens is that it takes a little while to readjust, and it takes longer than anybody expects. And no matter what country you're living in, you start to feel like, I felt like there was a Chinese mat, an American mat.
That's a good point. Yeah.
And when I came back, they didn't fit.
Yeah.
And so when I would talk to people, I was not connecting and it didn't make sense, or like they're just the dissonance. And it's worse when you're home, because you think it should work, right? Because you immediately go back to who you were before in your head. You remember it. But your soul is changed. And so basically what it required was, it was about like I left for 2 years, and it took about 2 years before I started to feel like those two parts integrated into one. And basically, I annoyed the heck out of everybody I knew, because I just tell them stories about the Shaolin Temple. Like, that was my way of dealing with it. Somebody would be talking and be like, oh, right, like at the Shaolin Temple. And then I'd start talking about it, which is how I ended up getting a book deal. I met some guy who was an editor, and he's like, a friend of mine. And I think he just got sick of me, and he was like, why don't you just write this down in a book? I do think that that happens to almost everyone, is that you have a sense of dislocation, and you simply have to reintegrate the two halves, the Australian you and the American you. Or you can become a wanderer, in which someone who just keeps going from place to place and adopting new things, and that becomes your identity, and you're no longer really the American you.
Flaneur.
Yeah.
It's a good point about having, a Chinese mat versus American mat. It's almost like a time capsule.
Yeah.
I feel like I come back and nothing has changed, or I went back to Australia after I had the surgery, and that was only after 2 months. But, you feel like you never left. You're in the morning taking the same train that you always take to work, and it's like, or coming back in the bathroom, there's the same finished bottle of toothpaste that somehow for 2 years people have still been trying to squeeze things out of.
All right.
But, all right, look, I don't want to harp on this for too long, and I want to be respectful of your time. So get through the back half of these questions.
No, I got time, as long as you want to talk.
So you did this again as a middle-aged man. So two questions here.
Yeah.
I'm not one to phrase things particularly elegantly, so this may sound rude.
That's all right. You're from Jersey. I take it that way.
Yeah. I am not from New Jersey. That's a dig. I'm from New York. There's a sharp distinction. I've never been from New Jersey.
That's only people on the East Coast think they're different.
Yeah. Okay. Someone said, so you're American. And I said, no, I'm from New York.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a difference. Okay. You know, you went back on and did this again. How did you fall off? You, at some point you said you weighed 250 pounds. I don't know how tall you are, but that.
I was big for then. I'm like 6'3", so you know, spread out a little bit. But yes,
How did you fall off, and then what motivated you to get back on?
Yeah, I came back to the States and was working in publishing, and you know, we would go out and drink and hang out, and I stopped working out. The gluttonous life of America, which we referenced before, I was eating too much sweet and not enough bitter.
Yeah.
So I reintegrated perhaps too well. And so, you know, I'd written the book American Shaolin.
Yep.
And I was looking for another topic. And at that point, that's when the UFC MMA fighting started to really take off.
What was this? When was the second book, or when did you undertake
the second book was undertaken in like probably 2007, I think, 2008. And so it was interesting when I talked to my editor about various projects I could do, and he was like, I mentioned MMA, and he's like, oh, that's the one. So in a certain way, it felt like a sequel. The book Tapped Out. Yeah. But it was also a chance to, it was sort of like the last shot at glory, right? The last chance to do this. Cause I was mid 30s by that point, early 30s, which is pretty old for someone who wants to get into cage fighting. And I kind of was excited about the possibility of seeing how much I could get back and what I had left. And so it was you know, I spent 2 years training in various countries, in Thailand, in Russia, Brazil, but mostly in Las Vegas, mm-hmm. where kind of the UFC is located. And, you know, I prepared for an amateur MMA fight and fought in it. So I did the whole journey. But it was a little different because it was specifically to write a book as opposed to my journey to the Shaolin Temple, which was much more personal. But, yeah, so that's in order to write the book, I had to dive back into it, and there was more resistance. It wasn't quite as pure.
You ever come across a guy named Jonathan Gottschall?
No.
Do you know Jonathan?
I don't think so.
We'll talk about that afterwards. He's a buddy. I'll connect you guys. He wrote a book called The Professor in the Cage, which is
I have read that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know it is. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
There you go. But look, on the subject of the fighting, but also cultural differences, different places. You were in St. Petersburg, you were in Rio, you were in Las Vegas, you were in Thailand. What are some of the differences in, I don't know if they're called dojos, but like the gyms, you know,
right.
What's the difference between a Thai gym and a Russian gym and a Brazilian gym? Like probably there's 100 differences, but this sure. is something that fascinates. I've just seen the movies, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, often what I think about is like, if I go in the gym and they're playing music, then you know, you're in a very Westernized gym, right? Mm-hmm. Cause anything Eastern, there's a certain sense of quiet. So Brazilian jiu-jitsu, while Brazilian, is still very influenced by Japanese. It came from Japan, and they still have a kind of strong sense of that. So you've got mats, and a lot of the training, at least the place I was in Brazil, felt more like you were in Japan or in the Far East. When you go into Vegas, it's like Vegas, right? They're playing music, there's TVs, it's rocking, people are carrying on. It feels much more like a sport. And I think the you know, what the West did to Eastern martial arts is turn them into sports, because that's what we're good at.
They turned it from an art into a sport?
Yeah, or a cultural product and a spiritual product. So what's interesting about traditional martial arts is they had several aspects to them. You know, there's a healing aspect. For example, like Tai Chi was considered a way to kind of keep your health and longevity, which is why you would see a lot of older Chinese people practice that. And then obviously there was a fighting aspect, but it was not for sport. It was, you know, traditionally for warfare. And there is a spiritual aspect, the idea of like what I would tell people is Kung Fu is a form of moving meditation. Mm-hmm. That the idea was you do these moves over and over again until you get into a state of kind of higher consciousness. And when you get to MMA in Las Vegas, it's just about the bling and the money and the winning, right? That's what they care about. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. The good thing about it is they get really good, because, you know, when a young man's motivated by bling and money and groupies and fame, he's highly motivated. So that's the big difference between the two. You know, one is purely for sport. It's commercial. It's about success. It's all winning and losing. And the other one has that to it as well. They're not free of the selfishness of the West. There's not a noble side and an ignoble side. But there are other aspects that were important to the development of martial arts and were considered when you were training. So there was an idea that this is some sort of spiritual practice when you were at the Shaolin Temple. And there's nothing spiritual about MMA.
I would think. I mean, it's not the case, because there's a whole industry around this, and it's just not what happens, as far as I understand. But I would think that then the Eastern fighters would be clobbering the Western fighters, because they're, you know, they're more spiritually engaged and they're, I don't know, maybe better. But they're still push. Conor McGregor wins fight, and he also loses them. But
sure.
Like, you know, I don't know. Is one better than the other? I think the spiritual one sounds nicer.
The spiritual one's
groupies and cocaine.
Yeah, it's better for your soul. But as I said, like, that's not what 18-year-old boys or men, young men, are motivated by, right? If you want somebody to train insanely, money, fame, and groupies and some cocaine is actually a better motivation than spiritual development. So there are obviously the Thai kickboxers are really great, and they're Chinese kickboxers. But again, those are both sports, right? Those are a combination of East and West. But traditional martial artists are not good in the cage. They have not succeeded. And Eastern fighters have not compared with Western fighters. All the best fighters are basically American, Brazilian, Eastern European.
What about... Oh, sorry, continue.
Yeah, yeah. So you could speculate on why that is. It may just be cultural. It's where the fights happen. So that's where the training is, and that's where the money is. You know, I think someday if MMA gets big in China, they'll produce some great Chinese fighters, just like they have in every other thing that they focused on. And there were some... Japan had a pretty good MMA tradition there for a while. But yeah, I don't know if it's genetic or what it is, but they're just not as strong in MMA, at least for now.
What about in a bar?
In a bar or fight?
In a non-cage environment on the street.
Right.
Would I rather have a Kung Fu guy or, you know?
No, you'd still rather have an MMA guy.
Why?
Because MMA fighting is closer to what an actual fight is like than Kung Fu is. The problem the traditional martial arts had was they accumulated a lot of kind of historical tradition. And so a lot of the techniques that were taught in traditional martial arts are not that effective in a street fight. But you did it because your master did it, because his master did it, because his master did it. So I think one of the problems with traditional martial arts was essentially they were too conservative and they were too tradition-based. And one of the innovations of MMA was to make it very American in that pragmatic sense, like what works, works, and what doesn't, we get rid of. And so, and because the sport itself has as few rules as you can have, basically without people dying, it allowed it to be as close as you could get to a street fighting circumstance. And so what's interesting is if you go watch UFC 1 through 5, the guys have no idea what they're doing. Like, those are my favorite UFCs to watch the first 4 or 5 years because they don't know what they're doing. Like, they're still figuring it out. They don't know what technique will work. They come in with some of their tradition. Some guy comes in with some traditional karate and gets crushed, or, you know, some jiu-jitsu guy wins a couple and he thinks he's great, and then he gets punched in the face and he's never not used to that. So the pragmatic aspect of essentially the cage being like a petri dish where you're engaging in repeated experiments to see what works has allowed it to advance. So now they all sort of fight the same and they've all figured out what kind of works, but they didn't know before. And so we essentially had like a 25 year experiment on what's effective. Now, there are aspects of a real fight that are nothing like being in a cage. The number one difference is, having been in a few bar fights myself, I can tell you that it never stays one-on-one. Mm. Like, when you're in a cage, you fight one guy. And when you're in a bar, his three friends jump you from behind. And then some random dude who just wants to get in a fight jumps in there too. And pretty soon there's five guys you're fighting and you thought you were just fighting one. So the techniques you use against one person are very different than the techniques you use against five. For example, in the cage, oftentimes though, you'll take somebody to the ground, right? You try to tackle them, throw them down to the ground, get on top, mount, or get on the bottom or whatever. An excellent technique against one person, a really terrible technique when you're in a, you know, a cowboy bar and there's five guys with boots kicking at you because you've just put yourself at boot kicking level. So that's, you know, just one example, but it's the most important one. And then, of course, the second issue is there's no weapons. And if you're in a real street fight, at some point somebody picks up a bottle or a bar fight and tries to bash you over the head with it. Or they got a knife on them. You know, you don't want to be grappling on the ground with somebody who's got a pulls a knife out of his side, out of his like belt. So there's a lot of techniques that, you know, work because it's one-on-one. It's in a contained space. The floor is matted, you know, it's not covered in broken glass like in a bar fight. So there's a lot of things that are different. So if you were in a real street fight, you would almost certainly want to stay on your feet and not go down if you could avoid it. And then a MMA fight going down is very useful.
Oh, keep that in mind.
Yeah. Just in case things get rough in Australia.
No, they do. So.
Yeah, I know. They're tough people. The people who got sent over there weren't the happy, genteel gentlemen.
There's a buddy, this guy Tom, he's telling me out in the country in Australia. So, you know, the coastlines are rather cosmopolitan.
Yep.
Kind of, I mean, in their own Australian way, whatever. But anyway, inland is like they call it the country.
Right.
You'd be at like a countryside pub and sometimes guy would just like, have a glass like this and he would just flip it over and he'd walk outside. And if other people saw that this guy had flipped his glass over, that was a signal that he was looking for somebody to fight.
Yep.
Not cause he's angry, just cause it's something to do.
No.
And then some guys would follow outside, they'd beat the shit out of each other and then they'd go back into the pub.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's one of the things I did learn and I found was interesting in my own self was that after a while, if you do it for a while, it can be fun. Like, people ask why fighters fight. It's an incredible rush. If you're properly trained, so you know how to mostly avoid being put in the hospital, you're probably not going to get hurt that bad. And it's intense. You know, it's the same reason soldiers go back to war. There's no more intense experience than two people like going at it. And so, you know, I grew up in Kansas. There were bars that people went to where they would be sitting around waiting. You know, you walked into that bar, you knew at some point there was going to be a bar fight. And people were there just to jump in. Like, they were going to start it, or they were going to respond to it, or they were going to jump in, or they're going to watch. But that's why you went. You know, the bar made its money based on people knowing there was going to be a bar fight. So, again, you know, Kansas is very much like in-country Australia. But and this, you know, when I lived in England, there were places like that too. People like to fight. You know, that's something that we don't in genteel society generally admit, but people like it. It's fun. It's fun to be in a real fight. It's not fun hurting somebody who's helpless unless you're a sadist. And it's not fun getting crushed, but a competitive fight with two people or three or four, and it can be a real rush.
What about when you're in these other parts of the world, whether it's St. Petersburg or Rio or whatever, you're just the white dude. Well, I mean,
yeah. You're a foreigner or you're the American or whatever. Yeah. I think in general,
maybe not the best place to start.
Yeah, somewhere else. You don't know the legal system, right? You don't want to be in some Moscow prison. I always find when you're in a foreign country, there's a certain sense of diplomacy, right? You're what I found interesting living in China is I realized many of the Chinese I met in the early 90s had never met a foreigner in their life. So their entire opinion of white people in general and Americans in particular would be based solely on how I behaved. And that there was a certain responsibility there, which also is what felt like a burden after a while, because you're always trying to be on your best behavior.
Yeah. Yeah. As the token representative.
Yeah. Yes. The one who represents all. Yeah.
What about, then we can move past some of the fighting stuff. I'm just fascinated by it because it's not my world.
Yeah.
I did competitive ski racing, but that's, it's different.
Yeah.
It's an extreme sport, but it's different. What about sort of underground fights, like Fight Club style, like, I don't know, bare knuckle brawling? The friends used to talk about that, or different places. You ever get mixed up with that, or it was all rather organized in the cage, you know, or even just need money, like or maybe you heard stories about it.
You know,
that's
never,
another world too, right?
Yeah, I never did. I mean, that's all in the movies, is from my experience. I mean, I'm sure occasionally that somebody arranges something like that.
Not Fight Club, like.
Yeah.
Proper rings.
Yep.
You know, but just in a basement rather than on TV.
Yeah, I unsanctioned fights.
Yeah.
And often they're called smokers from the old days, because the people would come in with cigars and the room would fill with smoke. and that's how they got the name for it. And usually they take place in kind of gyms, where they're just kind of unsanctioned. So, you know, what's the difference between, you know, fighting in Vegas versus fighting in a gym in New York versus, you know, it's really just about the safety and the rules. You know, if the rules are clear and you know, mostly what happens is you get one guy who's not very well trained and he loses quickly. But I didn't experience that much. Most of my experience was sort of gym related or kind of some sort of sanctioned event. I think there's a lot less than that of that than if you watch a lot of martial arts movies, you would think.
Fair because enough.
I mean, I suppose, yeah, I mean, yeah, they're just, I don't think there's that many places where you could actually go and fight the underground thing.
Okay. I have a question now.
Yeah.
It's about your junior year high school English teacher, Mrs. Bacalor. Who was Mrs. Bacalor to you?
Oh yeah, she was one of the, I wasn't a very good student in high school, and she sort of, or I wasn't very interested, and she was the teacher who sort of inspired me, and that was, she was like, you could be the best student I've ever had, and she was like, and you could be a Rhodes Scholar, which I didn't know what that was, and she's like, you could be my Rhodes Scholar. And she kind of gave me a confidence I didn't have in myself. And she's the reason why I was able to kind of achieve academically when I wouldn't have otherwise, because she was, you know, everybody who's gone on to something has one teacher who kind of got to them. And she was the one for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had two.
Yeah.
This guy, Champ Attlee, he just retired this year. He taught at the high school for more than 50 years. He went to the high school. And then he taught there for more than 50 years. Fan, just a wonderful, wonderful man. And another guy, Lawrence Philippone, who took me aside one day and said, you're the most interesting person I've ever met. And I found out later that he actually said that to a couple of different people, or a lot of people. But
as long as he didn't say it to everyone.
No, he meant it. Yeah. He meant, even if he did say it to everyone, this guy took a fucking very earnest interest in you. He looked at us as his children. He was such a fantastic teacher. All it takes is one person to really believe in you. I got deferred from Yale. I was really wanted to go to Yale. And I was all upset about it. And he goes, "Don't let one deferral make you somebody who defers to others." And I was like, "That's right. That's right.
That's well said. Yeah.
But great guy. So after Shaolin, you come back, you finish up Princeton, and then you went and got a Rhodes Scholarship. That's fucking cool. What's up with that?
I went to the interview and they were like, "What have you done for the last 2 years?" And I was like, "I was teaching English to Buddhist monks in China."
Yeah. So
everybody else in the interview process was like, "Oh shit." The Shaolin story, I think, was the difference, because there were a lot of people with better grades and probably smarter than I was. But I'd done something kind of unique and interesting. Although I had a friend joke that like everybody else had only taken 4 years to get the Rhodes, and it took me 6. So I had a little extra prep, but, it was Mrs. Bacalar who had said that to me, that she thought I could be her Rhodes Scholar, which, coming from Kansas, I didn't know what that was until I looked it up. And at that point I had to go to a library and pull out books, to figure out what it was. But it allowed me to get to go to England and study. And, you know, it was obviously a big boost in confidence. I kind of felt like if I could do this and do Shaolin, then I could actually be a writer, because that's what I wanted to be since I was little. And that's not a profession that is applicable to kids in Kansas. Like, that's just not something that you have any access to or you think exists. And so going there when I was in grad school is when I started writing. Trying to write seriously, and that's sort of was the beginning of the path I've continued to walk down since then.
But what I mean, you go there for what, a minimum of 2 years, right?
Yeah. So I was there for, I ended up staying for 3, because you could go for 2, but they'd give you money for 3, and I hadn't written anything good yet, so I was like, I might as well just hang out here with the stipend. And, you know, sort of, I was half-heartedly taking classes. I wasn't very interested in the classes. I was mostly interested in the writing I was trying to do.
And you were doing English or history or what?
I did PPE, which was politics, philosophy, and economics. So I did like a second bachelor's for 2 years. And then I did a social and economic history master's. I don't even think I finished that one. But by that point I had the same feeling I had it in China. It was like, okay, I've done this. I'm done. I'd like to go back, and I wanted to start my career. So I came back and, got a job in New York publishing at this tiny little magazine called Arthur Frommer's Budget Travel Magazine. And basically did what everybody in New York City at that time did. You meet people and go to parties and you try to write freelance pieces and you sort of,
I know the circuit.
Yeah. You run around and, try to get an agent and you try to slowly climb your way up the greasy pole.
The greasy pole, a pole with which I am familiar. I want to wrap up here now and talk about, you know, life after these things, right? You come back from Shaolin, you go back to Princeton. You come back from Rio and St. Petersburg and Thailand and Vegas, and you go back to sort of domestic life.
Yep.
You have a kid, you have a wife, you have a, you know, there's grass and trees in Connecticut, I think.
Yeah, that's the rumor. I don't know. That's what we tell New Yorkers anyway.
Yeah. So Connecticut, lovely state, unlike New Jersey. That's the last swipe I'll take in New Jersey. But, that's not true at all. I'll continue to swipe New Jersey. But anyway, do you get bored after doing these Odysseus? You're Odysseus. No, you are. And you go out and you do things and you come back to civil society, civilization. You know what? I was in Novi Sad this summer. So I did some of my research at Princeton on Serbian paramilitary organization in the 90s.
As right? one does, yes.
Yeah. As well, no, because
I'm just teasing.
Yeah. I was interested in the Pink Panther Diamond Thieves, right?
Okay.
This is a guy, David Samuels. He's been on this podcast. He's a writer. He wrote this long article in the New Yorker on the Pink Panther Diamond Thieves. And I was like, this is so fucking fascinating. Who are these guys?
Right.
So you start digging and there are a bunch of, you know, ex-Yugoslavs who coming out of the wars, like they're not, that's what they right. wanted to continue doing.
Right.
And so I became really fascinated by this one figure, Zelezko Rasinovic or Arkin. I'm trying to see if I have the book here. I have hundreds of books. I can't find it. But sure. Anyway, whatever. This is a long story, but mm-hmm. I was really interested in Serbian paramilitary organization. And there's this one group called the Arkin Tigers run by this dude Arkin that was staffed mainly with sort of thugs and hooligans from the Red Star Football Club. And that's the guys he recruited. Uh-huh. And this story was just insane. You know, he had an oil empire. You're from Kansas. They called Serbia at that time Arkansas because right. this guy had like a whole oil empire going on. You lived through this. And so I did not. I'm a bit,
you are.
A bit younger. Yeah. Anyway, fascinated by this, blah, blah, blah. I was in Novi Sad this summer. Visiting a woman who did research on organized crime in Serbia, who I became friends with years later when
yep.
I had first come across her when I was doing the research in Serbian paramilitary organization. I came across her years later when I was an editor at Quillette and I wanted her to write an article for us. And then we became friends. Anyway, I went to stay at our house in Novi Sad this summer. I ended up meeting this guy who's a rock star in the 80s at this band called EKV. And he was telling all these stories of Serbia in the 80s and 90s. And he goes that sometimes you want to ask what? That doesn't make any sense, but it's like that cultural lens thing. It's mm-hmm. like things are just different. So I was reading this, biography of Arkin the other day. Just he was a bad dude. He was going to be tried for war crimes. They've mm-hmm. killed him before. Some people still believe he is still alive somewhere, but you know, unlikely.
Right.
And so there's a thing. There was just one sentence in the book where this guy Christopher Stewart. I think he's an editor at the Journal now, the Wall Street Journal. But he wrote this book on Arkin called Hunting the Tiger. Maybe I'll have him on the podcast actually, but. I should invite him on. I'll make a note of that. But, you know, he's talking to someone and the guy says, you wouldn't understand. This is Serbia. And this is like a lot of cases. Things are different. So I found out, this is a long story, but basically I will condense it. I promise.
No. Keep going.
I had to go from Novi Sad to Belgrade at like 3 o'clock in the morning one night because I was staying with my friend in Novi Sad and I had to get to Venice for the Venice Film Festival, which I moseyed my way into into getting, you know, free tickets and whatever to that. And so the way things worked out is there was only like one 6 o'clock flight from Belgrade to Venice and I had to be in Venice at like 8 o'clock that morning. So I had to leave Novi Sad at 3 o'clock in the morning to get to Belgrade by 5 and then to get on the flight to Venice. I found out I don't know, however many months later, my friend in Serbia arranged for some dude to drive me mm-hmm. at 3 in the morning from Novi Sad to Belgrade. And that, you know, it's this whole Guanche thing or Wasta thing. People do each other favors. People know each other. Yep. What was I? Do I have no other options, really? There's no fucking Uber
right.
in this part of the world. So, not in this part of the world, but in
yep.
well, yeah, in that part of the world. Anyway,
that part of the world.
Yeah. So, this guy drove me, and I found out later he worked with a paramilitary group, as many guys who live in Novi Sad and Belgrade did. Apparently, he was just the accountant. Uh-huh. But I got a casual email the other day saying, by the way, the guy who drove you back, he was one of Arkin's Tigers. And I was like, oh, so nice of you to have put me in the backseat of this guy's car at 3 o'clock in the morning.
That's right.
And you know, she's like, ah, this is Serbia. Yes, and I was, Serbia. Yeah. So, I don't know. I don't know how I got on that little line of think. Oh, I remember coming full circle, coming back to the question. You know, are you bored by the chirping birds and the oatmeal?
You know, that's a very good question. I haven't been asked that before, but I do. I think what's interesting for me was I was very into at that time the kind of gonzo journalism.
I wrote my thesis on gonzo at Princeton.
There you go. So yeah. Hunter
Thompson, Hunter, Joe Didion, and George Plimpton. It was a 120-page thesis about them.
When I say participatory journalism, you're one of the few people who know what I'm saying.
Of course. Well, I had an editor at the Paris Review on this podcast. I love this shit.
It's the great stuff. P.J. O'Rourke was really the inheritor of Hunter S. Thompson, but funnier. Not that Hunter wasn't funny. And so I really wanted to be that kind of P.J. O'Rourke. Yeah. I think at a certain point I was like, I felt like I aged out. It's like a being an athlete, you know, the ability to go drink and carouse and visit foreign countries and do crazy things and then write funny stories about it. I just wasn't. Like, by the time I finished the MMA book, I was like, I just want to sit and have a lawn, research my book on Bruce Lee, and just read a bunch of books. But, you know, even with that, it took 6 months to go into Hong Kong. So the truth is, I think you never get to the point where you don't sort of have that itch occasionally. But definitely, you know, getting married and having a family, having a child, took a lot of that sort of wanderlust away. And I think it had mostly burned its way out. So I have a lot of times now where, you know, they're like, well, you want to come visit? And I'm like, I don't want to travel. What's that? An hour away? That's too far. So I think some of it's just sort of the time of your life, which period of your journey you're on. But when you're young and you're not settled down, that's the best. You know, you should just keep going around until you're sick of it. Because those experiences they're irreplaceable.
I think if you know, there's something to be said too about this notion that if you eat a big, delicious, juicy steak every meal, eventually you're not going to want steak anymore. If you eat too much chocolate, it loses its flavor. If you're just doing crazy shit all the time, it you become desensitized or whatever. Like,
that's right.
you need the oatmeal and the birds.
You do.
So
that's well said.
A Thai prison is still exciting.
That's right. If it's the 15th year you're in a Thai prison for smuggling drugs. Oh, whatever. I just got raped. There was that great movie about that guy who was like a kickboxer. Or he learned kickboxing in a Thai prison. It was really excellent. I can't remember the name. Anyway, I mean, one of the things I find is sort of, you know, when you have a kid, it becomes this whole new thing like that, where it's like such an adventure. But I wonder if when he goes off to college, I will suddenly want to, you know, visit the Congo or something, go in the heart of darkness. Or whether that period's completely passed, but it was exciting to do for a while.
I was invited recently. Well, actually, we're not going to talk about that.
No, not on air.
Certainly not. You ever come across a guy named Rolf Potts during your time writing for Slate?
Oh yeah, I know Rolf Potts. He was a travel writer. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Rolf and.
Or Salon, not Slate.
Yeah. He's been, I mean, Rolf Potts was like somebody who was like, I just want to be a travel writer.
Yeah.
So I think we were at a couple conferences and we hung out. nice guy, liked him, and very sort of purely dedicated to the art of travel writing, which I felt like was kind of something I fell into as opposed to the end goal. But yeah, I know Rolf. But it's probably been 15 years.
It hasn't quite been 15 for me, but when I was in high school, I bullshitted my way into this writing workshop that Rolf was running in Paris and, you know, convinced the powers that be to give me some money for this expedition.
Right.
When I showed up and people were confused. They were like, how old are you? And I was like, oh, well, you know, I'm a student. And people assumed I was a college student. It was Rolf's workshop. And so he goes, really, how old are you? And I was like, what, you know, I'm 16 or 17 or however old that was. He goes, what are you doing here? And he goes, I thought you were in college at least when I read your application. I was like, oh, well, you know, whatever. He goes, well, you're here. You might as well benefit from it. So I did the class with him and, you know, I don't know. I really liked vagabonding.
Yeah, vagabonding is an excellent thing. And that was, you know, that represented a certain period too, which was that kind of 90s, you know, white guy wandering the world and finding himself sort of thing where people
eat,
go to
pray, love.
Yeah, the eat, pray, love.
But Rolf was good. I think it was kitschy.
I'm not putting it down. I'm just saying that there was a kind of cultural moment where there was a lot of kind of storytelling like that and that kind of travel writing. And I think the internet crushed a lot of it.
TikTok.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, I joke that like there are video camera feeds of the Shaolin Temple. You can just go online and watch them.
Probably are.
There are. Yeah. So you can just go and see a webcam of all the people doing the training. There's no, what's the point of getting on a plane?
Yeah. Anyway, look, I think we covered a lot of stuff.
We did for sure.
But is there anything maybe I didn't ask about that you want to get into? Any new books you want to plug, or you think we've exhausted the menu here?
I think we've hit it pretty good. I did, you know, the Bruce Lee book bio was a lot of fun, and so it was fun to actually do something that was not participatory. And I think the most important thing for me is like it to do the thing you're afraid you can't do. Mm-hmm. And once you know you can do something, then it loses its, at least for me, loses the interest. And so if you're still challenging yourself with new things, that, you know, whatever that is, that's what it keeps you excited and it keeps you sharp. And the times that I've sort of failed the most, although I failed a lot, but the most was when I did something that I'd already done before.
That's a good point. Doing the thing you think you can't do, sort of writing the next chapter, yep. Living episodically as Hunter or George would. Yeah, certainly George. And who was Bruce Lee to you? That's something I wanted to ask. That's on my list of questions.
Yeah. Like he was a childhood hero. He was like, I was 12 when I saw Enter the Dragon. And so that was the very first, I had a phone call. So Bruce Lee was somebody who kind of inspired me to get involved in the martial arts. And that changed the whole kind of course of my life. And so in that sense, he's kind of a patron saint. On the other hand, when I got to be an adult, I didn't really think about him that often. So when I set out to start the book, it was sort of it was looking at your childhood hero through an adult's eyes. And I'm glad I waited until I was older to write a biography because I could understand things in a way that I wouldn't have, when I was younger and still kind of enthralled to him. And I could see him as a human being. And so that was, I think the thing that I was able to bring to the biography is to treat Bruce Lee as a very talented and very extraordinary, but still a human being.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. There's a, you know, that old expression, never meet your heroes or yes. Don't meet your heroes because they're people.
Just like, you know, exactly. And oftentimes they're that what makes them great is also what makes them jerks, right? And so you usually have an extreme personality who achieves real greatness. You know, the kind of, if they were, you know, nice guys don't change the world. That's the thing. So the problem is people want you to be the world's best martial artist and greatest kung fu master, and also a total sweetheart who's always faithful to his wife and never yells at anyone. And you don't get there. There are no version of that. You know, the total nice guy who does everything he's supposed to is, you know, working in middle management somewhere. The people who actually change the world are usually have an edge to them and usually have some real serious character flaws.
That's about accurate and lines up with my experience.
Exactly.
Anyway, Matthew Pauly, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Hey, man. Thanks for asking me. I appreciate it.